Maybe you've heard of spiritual disciplines or spiritual practices, but why would we focus on those being embodied? What difference do our bodies make when it comes to the spiritual life? Well, that's what we're talking about, especially since this is called the Embodied Faith Podcast. It seems pretty important. We're going to be focusing on why embodied spiritual practices. As always, I'm Jeff Holsklaw, and this is the Embodied Faith Podcast brought to you by Grassroots Christianity, which is seeking to grow faith for everyday people. Well, today joining us for the show is Josh Wilson. He is the leader, or one of the leaders, I think there's multiple leaders, of The Table, which is a multiracial microchurch movement in Boston. He has served in multicultural, multiracial churches in and around Chicago and Philadelphia and Boston. Josh, welcome to the show.
Hey, man. It's so great to be with you. I'm a fan of the podcast, so it's so fun to be on.
Oh, excellent. Well, thank you very much. Well, I was just announcing that, you know, season two is dropping, which is this episode is a part of it. And you're like, oh, I'm so excited because, you know, we just made a value of having embodied spiritual practices as part of your church DNA or something like that. You just said something briefly. Absolutely. And I was like, I'm going to invite you to have you on. So could you just kind of walk us through a little bit about what it means or why you put embodied in front of spiritual practices or spiritual disciplines? Why did you add that?
Oh man, I'm going to try and answer this question without, at least for the moment, telling my entire life story. But
no, you could tell the whole story.
Yeah. I think at its core for us, and I'll speak for myself. I was involved in crafting those value statements, or we talk about them as postures, even, and I think that has to do with a bit of the embodied nature of them as well. But for me, embodied spiritual practice really is about our Christianity and the way that we express it, not just being something that's cognitive, not just being something that's kind of left-brained, but really making its way down into our full selves, and that it shows up in our emotions and our hearts, that it shows up in our practices and the things we do. There's probably a few things going on there, and I've been talking about embodied spiritual practice for a while. I would say that over the period of time that I've been thinking and talking about that, the focus has probably shifted and evolved a bit. But this idea of it being that our faiths don't just live at a cognitive space in our brains is probably core to that for me.
Well, and you mentioned just before we jumped on that some of this is part of your own faith journey, and, you know, and then you use the famous or infamous words of deconstruction and reconstruction. How is it that this idea, emphasis on embodiment, has been a part of that kind of process for you?
Oh my gosh. Such a huge part of it.
Wait, you only have 2 minutes.
Two minutes? Yeah, that's not going to, no. Well, I won't tell my whole story, but I will say that, you know, it is very personal for me. I grew up, my formation began in what would be self-described as a fundamental Baptist space. And in a lot of ways, my family and even I personally were kind of heroes of that kind of Christianity growing up. We were all the way bought in. My parents were and are just incredibly sincere, devout people who really love Jesus and others and have devoted themselves to kind of spreading the gospel. When I was 10 years old, my family moved from the Midwest. We lived in a rural town in Ohio to Moscow, Russia as missionaries to plant a church.
Whoa.
So it was kind of all the way in it, which kind of elevated us to this hero status within kind of our little fundamental Baptist tribe. And then I you know, kind of continued that journey. And in some ways, some question marks began to pop up along the way. But I also saw a lot of good, particularly in my parents' lives. I went on to a very fundamentalist school for my undergrad to train really to follow in my parents' footsteps. But I'm a super curious person. I tend to interrogate things and just keep asking questions and go further and further down the rabbit hole. And along that journey, some things just started to not make sense, not add up. I started to realize there were some things here that needed to be pulled apart. And I would say initially that was very much of a cognitive thing for me. It was, you know, at the head level as I was wrestling with the relationship between church and culture. But I began to kind of, you know, nibble around the edges of deconstruction, you might say. I wasn't the kind, as many of my peers were, who just threw the whole thing in the waste bin and went off drinking. Maybe I was just too nerdy and uncool to get invited to the parties. I'm not sure. But it was a process of deep theological reflection. And at a certain point, specifically, I was a couple years into that process. I was now in seminary in Pennsylvania, leading in a church plant that was more of a non-denominational hipster church plant type of a space. I had evolved from my fundamentalist Baptist roots at that point. And in the midst of this, my marriage, my first marriage at the time, collapsed. My wife left me and the faith. I was just blindsided and crushed. And what that experience exposed for me really was that our faith, both hers and mine, had been just incredibly hollow. We were in many ways kind of what people had been pressing for within our little expression or stream of Christianity. We were what the other parents told their kids, you know, you should be like these guys. And yet at the same time, there wasn't a depth, there wasn't an embodiedness to our faith. It was very cognitive. It was behavioral in the sense of like, don't do these things, do these things, serve in ministry. But when you get to attachment, when you get to love, it was very thin. And for my ex-wife and I, that has led to different outcomes. I have continued to hang around with Jesus, although for a long time, I wasn't sure if the problems that I was kind of deconstructing was the entire Jesus movement or just this stream of kind of American Christianity that I had been seeped in. Sure. That quest really drove me to pursue with a lot of intensity this question of like, how does genuine transformation happen? How do people become people who live and love like Jesus, which is the table or church's mission statement? And that quest has really propelled me into this question of what does an embodied faith look like, both for the church in terms of its social action and engagement on issues of politics and race and things like that, but also individually in terms of our emotional life and our relational life. How do we become people who in an embodied, holistic way really love well?
Yeah, for sure. Well, and that, I think that kind of story really resonates with people and it kind of represents a lot of people where this kind of, you said hollow, shallow, brainy faith just could not kind of weather the storms of life, end up creating kind of false expectations and then it just crumbled. And then I think you ended up like finding someone like Dallas Willard or other kind of spiritual formation kind of people. And so you were introduced to like spiritual practices, but when you really have been emphasizing this idea of embodiment, what do you think, like, why do you think that'll do good work in like your churches, the microchurch movement in Boston? Like, what is your hope that people would be able to live into then as a response to this idea of like, we're really focusing on being embodied as followers of Christ?
Yeah, I think, you know, I would say we're looking at both. I see the body, right, and our embodied faith as both a part of the answer to how do people change and also a piece to the measurement of, well, if we have changed, if we're following Jesus, if we're beginning to live and love like Jesus, what do our lives look like? Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think it changes the way that we think about both of those things. I'm probably, we could really go a long way down either of those trails, but an embodied faith, obviously, you get into some of the stuff, like you mentioned Dallas Willard earlier, who has been just one of the most, if not the most influential kind of thinker and theologian in my own development and theological development. There have been many, many others at this point, but Dallas was one of the first folk who really helped to really kind of in the spiritual formation movement, introducing these ideas of spiritual practices and things like that. There's also, when I think of kind of a faith that is embodied in terms of how we form people, obviously habit formation begins to come into play, right? You begin to get into conversations around attachment and how our social relationships and our social formation relate to the people that we are becoming. And of course, there's a lot that neuroscience has to say about that. So there's a number of different ways, I think, where there are shifts that need to occur if we really take our embodied selves seriously in the way that we do spiritual formation and transformation. And then, of course, so many ways in which the outcomes would be measured, not simply in kind of the way in which we answer questions with the correct propositional truths, but by, you know, as Jesus talked about, the quality of our love for one another, the way that we live in community, the way that we care for the poor, the way that we navigate things like finances and our lived environment. So anyway, there's many other hopeful consequences sure. to that kind of embodied formation, I think.
So spiritual formation, transformation, or how do people change were kind of the things that were animating your questions and your hopes mm-hmm. for the church and for your own life. And you'd already come to the conclusion that, you know, just better Bible knowledge, clearly articulate and orthodox, you know, version of the doctrine of the Trinity or something like that, that doesn't really change the heart of people. So what real practically then, what would like an embodied practice or an activity like kind of look like? What are you calling your people into then? Whether it's
a great question
or week by week kind of process.
Right. So, I think there's a lot of answers to that. One of the beauties and challenges of being in a multiracial microchurch movement is, while I am a leader, there's no universal thing that is happening across the movement with all people and all microchurches in the same way. But, you know, some of the things that we do are just to be very, very tangible is, I would say, in our like Sunday environments, right? Where we're having kind of a hub gathering, a traditional Sunday worship service type of a thing. You know, I and others still preach and teach in those spaces. But I would say that has been de-emphasized relative to kind of the primacy of place that has been given in most kind of evangelical churches today. We regularly have extended times of spiritual practice together. So this Sunday, we're training on a discipleship tool, and we spent a long time in silence together as part of our kind of hub worship gathering. And then we spent time in breakouts, kind of engaging that and exploring that and discussing the experience and thinking about what that could look like to bring that into our daily lives. Mm-hmm. So that's just one very tangible example. I think we also have a very intentional discipleship pathway that we've built that brings a lot of these things in other types of spaces and environments to bear in ways that allows people to really experientially and socially engage in concepts rather than it simply being, here's a cognitive piece of information that I'm communicating.
So it's not just information sharing, it's this doing things, so like corporate spiritual formation. Like silence. What would be some other, whether they're corporate or individual, what are some other like breath prayers or
we've done Lectio, we've done imaginative, we've done readings of scripture, we've done any number of, if you can think of a spiritual practice that's common in evangelical or liturgical spaces, we've probably done it in a public space. Mm-hmm. So yes, I would say incorporating those things, but it goes beyond that as well. One of the things that's been really began to shift the way I related to some of these questions of formation and change was I attended together with my wife a series of kind of 4-day transformational trainings that really had these bold promises about change and were really vague and unclear. And we got into the spaces, and I would say on the other side of those, they've been some of the most personally impactful and transformational spaces that I've ever had the opportunity to be a part of. But what they really did was they created shared experiences for people. And then they took a coaching posture to debrief those experiences. And then maybe after the fact, there was a frame to like explain what had happened. But we try and bring some of that same methodology into the ways that we actually do discipleship. This would be less probably in a Sunday worship type of a space, but within some of our discipleship cohorts and those types of environments where we're creating by way of, experiential exercises, right? We have people do things together, whether it's collaborating on a project together, often a project for mission, or even doing something that you could almost see more more in the corporate training space, like a team building exercise or something. But things that are very intentionally designed to surface the types of things that happen in real life, the types of dynamics that we're trying to get at, such that people aren't simply responding to a concept at a cognitive level, but their bodies have been engaged in a process. They've actually done something. They've done something socially together in a way where they're confronted with a reality of how they show up and how they love and how they actually relate with others in a really tangible way. Mm. And then I think when we respond less with a kind of just in case, let me just tell you all the information, but kind of a just in time intervention that says like, hey, here's this dynamic that actually just played out between you and another person in real time. And how else is this playing out in your life? Oh, as it turns out, this plays out with my spouse all the time, right? And then all of a sudden we're doing discipleship about real relationships and real spaces based on concrete experiences. And for us, bringing those things in, and we're still, I would say, iterating and learning to do that well, borrowing from others, but leveraging some of these types of approaches to discipleship is incredibly embodied and has really helped people see profound experiences of transformation in our context here.
So then the two things that I heard, because I think a lot of times when I think of spiritual practices, I think of, I do them alone and I kind of do them in my head. You know, maybe I pray a Jesus prayer by holding beads. So maybe that's kind of embodied, but I'm really kind of engaging my consciousness. But it sounds like two of the things that you are emphasizing is that we really need to be relationally working together. And so actually you don't do, part of being embodied in these spiritual practices is you're not doing them alone. And then what I also heard was kind of experiential learning. Like you're actually kind of, you know, you're just doing it. You're in it and doing it together. And so I think that kind of helps us kind of, for those who kind of have heard of spiritual disciplines or spiritual practices, and they think they're spiritual. So they're like out of my body and they're individual. They're done alone. What you're trying to say is, well, if they're embodied, they're really, you know, we're doing them together. Can you tease out that distinction? You said just in case learning and then just in time learning. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so two just different ways or a lens for thinking about the information that we receive, right? And obviously some learning or that we put in kind of the just in case category would be the types of things that most of us learn in school, right? And the types of stuff that honestly most of us learn in church. So it's how to do math, right? Or it's you know, how to read and study our Bibles, right? Or the eschatology, right? It could be any number of things, but things we're being taught, whether it's a skill or a competency, or just like a data set, right? A bunch of facts or a worldview. We're kind of being taught this, and we're saying, you know, hey, at some point, this is going to be important for you. Right. At some point, this will be relevant. Like these are things that you just should know, just, you know, just in case. Like there's probably some point where this is useful. Whereas just in time learning, I think is really responsive to what people are actually experiencing. It's the situation where a couple is coming into counseling because of a problem in their marriage. Right. And I think for any of us who are teachers, we know that the person who is studying because they're actually in the midst of something, they're actually receiving an answer to a question rather than just something that maybe will be useful at some point down the road. It really makes all the difference. And of course we see, you know, I'm not trying to denigrate just in case learning. I think there's a time and a place for it, but so much of the ministry that we see in Jesus, right, is this just in time learning. He's actually doing things together with his disciples. They're sharing experiences and then they're going and debriefing them and they're having actual learning that's responsive to the events of their lives. So that doesn't work with programs, right? You know, if you're running a program and you need 100 people to show up, it's really tough to find 100 people who are all going through the same experience at the same time. So there's a time and a place for just-in-case learning. I'm not against it, but I do think that to the degree that we can find pathways and environments and build structures that help people to learn the things that they need to learn at the time when they're actually asking the questions, or as we've done a bit, actually create experiences which raise the question for people in tangible ways, right? Actually give people an experience, ask people to go on a missional project together or do something, right? Which generates a set of questions for people. Mm-hmm. That then all of a sudden they're much more eager to engage or to learn from than if you just give them the information in a vacuum.
So part of the experiential and relationally embedded learning is you're prompting a crisis that then you can give just in time teaching to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would say that's exactly right.
I like it. Very good.
So I spend a lot of my life trying to come up with creative ways to meddle and create mischief and to raise questions that are real for people, but in a way that brings them to the surface. And of course, if you think about Jesus' teaching methodology, if you think about the way he used parables, this was so much of what he did, right? He asked questions to provoke people to really wrestle with issues, to come back to him at a point where they were actually ready to learn. Mm-hmm. And so, how do we do that? I've never had a class. I wish we had classes and seminaries that helped us wrestle with how to do this. We're out here kind of iterating and figuring this out, but I think it's an important question for any of us who really want to help people navigate this transformational process.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I like that reference to what Jesus did, because he would definitely give a parable and the disciples would be like, hey, we didn't know what you were talking about. Like, what do you mean? Right. Haven't we already given up everything to follow you? And now, and they're just like in crisis. So what I'm hearing from you is that the role of a leader or a pastor in a church is to regularly throw people into crisis so that then you can teach them and inform them.
So some of the people in our movement would agree with your assessment of my leadership, okay. But that I'm not sure that that's actually exactly what I'm going after, but yeah, or at least not rescuing people from their experiences. Or, it's easy to criticize the helicopter mom who does that with her kids, right? But how often do we as pastors and as professors and people who are teaching and training disciples, do precisely the same thing, as opposed to allowing people to actually engage experientially spaces and creating a context of coaching and care where we can create a safe space for them to ask and wrestle with the questions of what it looks like to follow Jesus in that space.
Yeah, great. Well, just to wrap up, as you've been trying to do this and you bring people in, you've probably kind of hit resistance or confusion. What do you think are the theological or maybe cultural barriers that people have that causes them to either not understand, appreciate, or to neglect kind of this embodied kind of perspective?
Oh man, there are a bunch, unfortunately. I wish that wasn't so. I'm thinking of the story of the rich young ruler, and I would say often it just costs too much, right? Mm-hmm. And often that cost, at least here in Boston, is really one of time. People certainly here are so busy. Life is very full. And slowing down enough to actually live in thick community, to make space for shared relationship, this gets into the need for proximity and some of these things. We've really structured a whole church ecosystem that is tailored to run programs and provide kind of disembodied cognitive focused learning. And so, how do you actually have thick relationships with people in a way where you can have the raw source material for this kind of just-in-time learning that we've been talking about? I would say hurry is the number one issue. And of course, I'm back to agreeing with Dallas here in terms of it being, the core obstacle to the spiritual life. Hurry would definitely be one. I also think that we, and maybe I'm speaking specifically to some of my conservative evangelical and fundamentalist background here, but man, we're really addicted to getting the right propositional faith correct and being really certain about that and defending that kind of system of theological beliefs. And I'm not against propositional beliefs or any of those types of things. I just, like Jesus, am really concerned that those things work their way down into our bodies, into our life, into our love. Mm-hmm. But when people are oriented towards that, then it makes sense that the preaching act is the be all end all, and that the teaching, right, that the teaching and scripture is this entire focus. And I wouldn't say that we de-emphasize teaching or scripture, but they're in a context of life together, right? And so we spend time doing things that look almost like psychology that just sit with where people are really at before we take them to scripture sometimes. And then we spend time with things that look almost like coaching with helping people figure out what does it mean to actually walk this out in obedience, right? And that just, that requires slowing everything down and taking more time together. And oftentimes we're so attached, I would say, to this doctrine of individualism, this kind of cognitive approach to Christianity and to our busy lives that frankly, it's easier to be disembodied in our faith.
Mm. Well, I think that's a great place to end and a kind of a great final exhortation is that embodied practices, following Jesus, as you say, learning to live and love like Jesus takes time and it takes thick relationships. And it seems like our culture is manufactured to exactly travel in the opposite direction. So let's all figure out how to take time for one another, take time for Jesus, and kind of thicken our relationships with each other. Well, thanks so much, Josh, for taking some time and jumping in. Any last thoughts? Anything that you just like, oh, I really want to say?
No, I think this is great. I'm right with you. It's just, you know, it's one day and one step at a time.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. As always, you can find the Embodied Faith Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, on iTunes, on Spotify. We're also on YouTube, on my channel, Jeffrey Holsklaw. So please like, rate, review, and do all that stuff. And again, thank you, Josh, for coming on today.
Oh, man, it's been a blast. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, well, maybe we'll talk again sometime about that microchurch thing that you're doing.
I'd love to.
All right, we'll talk to you.